You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Hope you had a wonderful 4th of July weekend. Not everybody in America did over the past 7 days. Well, actually, just over the weekend, 10 people accidentally killed with 10 children accidentally killed with firearms. Over the week, the ages of the kids accidentally killed with firearms. 3, 6, 6, 7, 9, 11, 11, 15, 16, 16, 17, 17, and two of unspecified ages. Yet another Kentucky preschool age boy was shot and killed by his sister. Gunfail 25. David Waldman's keeping track of this week by week. We're up to week 25 now over at Daily Kos. With Independence Day behind us, he says serious casualties were mercifully low, although someone in Central Virginia will have to ponder whether his or her July 4th celebration of freedom was really and truly worth taking the life of a 7-year-old boy who died of a head wound. 10 families were sitting in their homes minding their own business when someone else's exercise of their Second Amendment rights apparently overrode their property rights. And he goes through a long list of people who got shot in their own homes because somebody nearby was out playing with their guns. Very interesting stuff going on here in America right now. We will, by the way, we're going to get to the Trayvon Martin trial where James Bamford is going to be on. We're going to be talking about the NSA and why Edward Snowden had to flee the U.S. It's anything goes summer, so whatever is on your mind. Plus, we've got more of the news of the day that I want to get into. But first, Neil McCabe is with us. He's a conservative commentator, editor of the Guns and Patriots newsletter, Neil W. McCabe, MCCABE.com is his website. Neil, welcome back to the program.
Hey, good to be with you, Tom.
You know, Neil, the old joke used to be that your right to swing your arm ends at the tip of my nose. This gun situation seems like it's a little out of control. And B, now we've got Kansas, where the Kansas legislature said, okay, cool, let's have teachers carry guns. And the insurance company said, okay, fine, you're going to do it without our insurance. I suppose you could claim that as a victory for the free market?
Well, I mean, a little bit. I mean, there's going to be some touch and go as we continue to restore Americans' gun rights. But, you know, guns themselves are insurance. And certainly we don't decide whether or not we're going to follow the Constitution based on a private insurance company.
We're restoring gun rights? When were gun rights taken away? Are you talking about gun confiscation laws back in the early part of the 19th century? I mean, the late 1700s, early 1800s, there were literally hundreds of towns around America where when you came into town, you had to leave your gun with a sheriff.
I don't think we have the gun rights.
That was the norm in the Old West, in fact.
Well, I think we need to expand gun rights, and certainly we see what with Governor Quinn's sort of quasi-veto in Illinois, you know, there's millions of Americans in Illinois who don't have nearly the gun rights that were anticipated when the framers wrote the Second Amendment.
Well, why don't we just go back to the way that it was in so many counties? It wasn't so much in the South. I'll give you that because they had the slave patrols and they were all quite well armed. But in the North and in the West, as the West was being expanded during the time of the writing of the Constitution and in the decades following it, most towns in America, or many towns in America, required you to turn your gun in to the sheriff's office. You pick it up when you leave, when you come into town. There were no gun zones. That is the history of our country, as you well know, Neil. Shouldn't we go back to that?
Well, I think that's also a time when every household was required to, or at least the males within a certain military age, were required to actually have working weapons, and they were drilling on the town square.
So respectfully, Neil, A, that was only in the South with regard to the slave patrols, and B, only at the turn of the 19th century, in 1800, the year Thomas Jefferson was elected. Best estimates are, and there's some pretty reasonable math done by people on your side, that between 16 and 19% of American families owned a gun. Fact of the matter is they were incredibly expensive things to own, and they required an enormous amount of maintenance because they rusted easily. So most people didn't own a gun.
But you could have one. And then, of course, when they invented the lathe, which allowed the price of gun stocks to drop, then you know, it was stainless steel. A document, a democratization of gun ownership. But I mean, what we're seeing in, you know, what you were talking about with Kansas is, if there's a private insurance company, you know, the private insurance market is failing. Are you suggesting that the government should step in and fill in the gap where the private insurance market fails?
No, what I'm suggesting is that the private insurance market is validating the wisdom of governments that said, on our government property paid for by our taxpayers, where we're teaching our children, we collectively, we the people, as in the constitutional sense, are going to say, no thanks, this is a gun-free zone. And when the good Republicans of Kansas said, oh no, we're not going to do that, we're going to start putting guns on the hips of teachers where kids can just grab them and point them at people, the insurance company said, what, are you crazy?
Well, I think that, you know, we saw, you know, what happened with Newtown. And that if there was an armed American at Newtown, conceivably that tragedy could have been ended.
There were two armed Americans when Gabby Giffords was shot. It didn't stop any. But in fact, the guy who the woman who took down the shooter, it was, you know, a middle-aged mom. She did not have a weapon. Yeah, anybody anybody who starts firing into a crowd of children, Neil, is crazy.
I mean, it's, you know, many Americans would prefer to have the chance that a gun would give you against the spree shooter.
I don't think so. If you look at what happened,
hide under our desk. We would just hide behind a tree.
Go back to the shootings in America where there were armed people around. What did they do? They ran in the other direction with their guns.
Well, I mean, we were talking about the West. What really disarmed the West was the fact they showed that as soon as the population of a town reached 25 to 30% female, that's when the gunfighting stopped, because the women just put an end to it.
So
maybe that's your answer.
So, you have stats to back that up?
Not in front of me, but
I'm guessing that the only towns that were more than 50% male were the boom town, you know, the mining towns, the gold rush towns, the early ones.
Sure, you're on the outskirts, but as the females went west and people started having families, I mean, that's when the gunfighting stopped.
Yeah. Okay, may well be. All that argues for is the need for more women in politics, doesn't it? Doesn't that kind of point out that the most dangerous drug in the world is testosterone?
Well, I think young unmarried men are the most destabilizing sector of any society. And that's why they created the Inquisition, the Crusades, just to sort of the Europeans just said, why don't you go somewhere else and have mayhem?
But can we just agree, Neil, that pre-adolescent kids and guns should not be in the same room?
Say again? I'm sorry, on a train.
I'm sorry. Can we just agree that pre-adolescent kids and guns should not be in the same room, even if the gun is carried by a teacher?
First of all, there's nothing about being a teacher that means that you don't know how to handle a gun or that a gun is going to be unsafe. And the idea of a child running up and grabbing a gun, I'm not sure at what grade that's going to be or how it can be set up. But there are many parents after Newtown who had the opportunity to sort of look at that situation and say, wow, if there was someone there armed, this thing could have been stopped. I mean, we know.
I don't think so. I think that's an NRA wet dream, but I don't think so. I think it's just a fantasy. But we'll have to, Neil, we'll have to leave it at that. You believe it, I don't. We'll agree to disagree. It's always good talking with you. Neil McCabe, neilwmccabe.com, the website. Thank you, Neil. Good talking with you, Dave. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It seems like it's time to do something about this, you know, and putting guns in the hands of teachers, not the brightest thing. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. I think this is hysterical. Kansas Republicans say, hey, you know, let's start giving guns to teachers. And Des Moines-backed EMC Insurance, which covers 85 to 90% of Kansas school districts, says, sorry, we have this longstanding policy, not as insurance policy, but as is in, you know, criteria for underwriting, which says that if a school arms its employees, we're not going to insure that school. Now, you think that might be because they know something that the Republicans don't? They say one of the underwriting guidelines we follow for schools is that any on-site armed security should be provided by uniformed, qualified law enforcement officers. Meanwhile, Newcomerstown, Ohio, says they're going to let employees carry guns. So your janitor might have a gun. Who knows? The guy doing yard work could have a gun. And I'm telling you, this fantasy that if there'd just been somebody with a gun in Newtown, like if there'd just been somebody with a gun in Columbine, I'm pretty sure it was Columbine. There were two people with guns, and they turned and they ran in the other direction. There were people with guns standing around when Gabby Giffords was shot, and nine people were killed. And as I recall, maybe it was seven, but a bunch of people were killed, a bunch of people were shot. And what did they do? They did the responsible thing that a person carrying a concealed weapon would do. They didn't shoot into the crowd. I mean, you're going to shoot at the shooter, but, you know, even cops don't, you know, who do this for a living, arguably, don't always hit the guy that they're aiming at. And if the guy that you're aiming at is surrounded by a crowd of people, that's pretty dumb. Just saying. So there's that going on. Egypt is still trying to figure out what to do. The situation in Egypt, I think that the best analogy that I've heard so far is that what happened in Egypt would be what would have happened in the United States if somebody like Mike Huckabee had become president of the United States. Somebody who is overtly a conservative Christian who believes that a woman's place is in the kitchen, that they shouldn't be out in public where they can be seen, and who believes that the official status of the country in terms of law should be under a law established by a Bronze Age god, and or more recently. I guess Islam is not quite from the Bronze Age. It's less than 1,000 years old. But you get the point that you know, much like George W. Bush packed the Justice Department with recent graduates of Jerry Falwell's Liberty University. But he didn't. And you know, he was doing some of that stuff. But he really wasn't overtly rewriting our laws, although you've got a lot of Republicans aggressively trying to do this right now. By doing things like, in the name of stopping abortion, actually closing down access to things like clinics where women can get mammograms, women can get cervical cancer checks, women can get birth control pills, women can get advice and counseling on how to use birth control, women can get counseling for rape, women can get information if once they're pregnant, if they choose to keep their child, if they choose to run their pregnancy to term. Then, you know, somebody who will be with them and provide them with prenatal counseling and guidance and nutrition suggestions. All that stuff is going away. In states where Republicans are passing these bills, where the theoretical purpose of the bill is to extend from 20 weeks to reduce from 24 weeks down to 20 weeks, the date at which an abortion can no longer be had. In fact, that's less than 1.5% of abortions. So 95% of what the bill does, 98.5% of what the bill does, is it restricts a whole bunch of access to a whole bunch of different services that are of value to women and girls. So, you know, if you had somebody like that running the country and they just started running the country down this road of, you know, let's have more and more Christian laws. And let's put all our Christian guys, our fundamentalist Christian guys, hardcore men, in places of power, in all the appointed places of power, and let's rewrite the Constitution to say that it's a fundamentalist Christian nation. That's basically what Morsi did, just substitute the word Islam or Muslim for Christian. And the people of Egypt are saying, you know, we don't like this. We don't want mullahs running our country. We don't want imams running our country. We don't want... We don't want politicians who are swearing that their first loyalty is to religion rather than to the nation. We don't want them running the country. And then you get this backlash. You get a bunch of guys, a bunch of men out in the streets saying, you know, hey, wait a minute. Egypt should not be a secular country. We should be a religious country. We should be bowing to Islam. And those women who go out in public, they need to be punished. And they're organizing, literally organizing public gang rapes as a way of keeping 50% of the population away from the demonstrations. That 50% of the population that is overwhelmingly likely to say, no, we really don't want the Muslim equivalent of Jerry Falwell, the Muslim equivalent of Ralph Reed, the Muslim equivalent of Paul Cameron running our country or in positions of power. I don't get why more Americans can't see the very clear analogy between what's happening in Egypt right now and what so-called Christians, and I have to say so-called Christians, because this is not the kind of stuff Jesus ever would have had anything to do with, are doing in our legislatures, in our newspapers, in our media, and on and on and on it goes. Meanwhile, Republicans say they're going to hold our nation hostage again. This should be entertaining. Last time they tried that, didn't quite work out so well. You know, our bond rating went down. Of course, they're trying to do that. They want to destroy it. These are people who hate America. You know, ever since Ronald Reagan said America's bad, America is the problem, it's not the solution, government is the problem, not the solution. Ever since Ronald Reagan made it fashionable and popular for Republicans to hate America and to rag on America, now you've got a group of Republicans in the House and Senate who are saying they're going to destroy America. They're going to ruin this country. They're going to break our credit rating, anything they can to harm our country. It's really sad.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
All in the name of discrediting or damaging the presidency of Barack Obama. Because after all, he is that black guy in the White House, right? Helping you win the water cooler wars. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Post 4th of July. I had a great 4th of July weekend. We went to Michigan for my nephew's wedding, and it was so sweet. It was so nice. I'm pleased to be there. And my brother Steve, he's got two new guns. They're both SIGs. One is a 32. They're both semi-automatics. One's a 32 and one's a 9mm. So one of these days, we're like, Louise and I have to get over there and try these things out. See, I'm not anti-gun. I think target practice is actually fun, although it does concern me all that lead exposure, but nonetheless. I'm just like anti-guns in houses with kids, anti-guns in schools with kids. You know, we've got, you know, what, 20 people killed over this last week by accident? That's Newtown. And that happens week after week after week after week after week after week. We don't need more guns, in my opinion. I mean, outside, I get it. Most people, actually, the majority of Americans don't own guns. And the people who do tend to be more like my brother Steve, who kind of collects them, I guess, you could say. And you know, enjoys them. But, you know, he's not. Well, I don't want to talk about Steve, but it's like I think most responsible gun owners are not the threat to America. It's the irresponsible gun owners. It's the people who you know, just, oh, I was just cleaning my gun, or I just left it on the kitchen table. I didn't realize the grandkids would be, you know, that kind of thing. And then, oops. And I think, personally, the only way to deal with this is to do the exact same thing we do with guns that we do with cars. Bring the insurance companies into the act. I mean, just like in Kansas, when the Kansas legislature says, okay, cool, you know, we're gonna start giving teachers guns. The insurance companies say, well, good luck. We're not going to insure you. I think anybody who owns a firearm, it ought to be registered. It ought to be insured, at least liability insurance. Or the owner should be insured. and there should be proof of proficiency. Very simple stuff. Anyhow, Billy in Weberly, Texas.
Good morning, or good afternoon, Tom. Listen, you were just drawing a couple of very false equivalencies between the Muslim Brotherhood and conservatives in this country.
Not conservatives. My dad was a conservative, and he was absolutely unlike the Muslim Brotherhood or Ralph Reed. He never would have wanted religion to be the guiding standard of any political party.
The comment that Ronald Reagan hated America and that America was the problem. What he said was the government was the problem. That's just an outright
lie. The government is what George Washington had three horses shot out from underneath him to create.
Well, that was a government in George Washington's time.
Well,
Obama's job.
The government is what Ronald Reagan ran for president to run.
And he said
if he disliked the government so much, why did he want to run it?
Nobody dislikes the government. We conservatives dislike the overreaching nature of the government as it's currently being managed. And you made the comment about the 24.
How is the government overreaching in your life, Billy?
Well, you were just talking about guns, for example. All right.
All right.
The Brady Bill was enacted back in whenever it was, 86.
Brady Bill is no longer law. How is the government overreaching in your life?
Well, the federal form you got to fill out when you buy a gun. You just talked about having a couple of guns given to you or bought for you.
No, actually, they're my brother's. My brother picked up a couple new guns. He's got several firearms.
But the federal firearms, that federal firearms form, I was actually denied purchase of a gun a couple of years ago. When I looked into it, it got in touch with the National Instant Check Service, which is near impossible to do. And the reason they denied my application, my purchase of that shotgun was because I had an outstanding speeding ticket. And that's not the way it was sold to us. When you get government power like that, Tom, they are always going to abuse it.
Billy, you know, I'm going to agree with you on that, but probably for a different reason. A very good friend of mine is a medical doctor, and he moved up to Canada. He wanted to practice medicine in Canada and ultimately retire in Canada. They have a national health care system. He can make a decent living and, you know, get a lot more work done and a lot less dealing with insurance companies. And he was in his 50s, and he figured when he retired, Canada has a decent retirement program. And they discovered that he had a speeding ticket, literally a speeding ticket, and they threw him out of the country. And the reason why is because, Louise and I, when we applied for the fast entry into the United States thing, you know, the guy is saying to Louise, you know, have you ever had a speeding ticket? Those are considered crimes. And I don't think they should be considered crimes. But for some reason, most states list speeding tickets as crimes so that if you have enough of them, apparently, they can either put you in jail or take your car away or whatever. And I agree with you. I don't think a speeding ticket should disqualify you from owning a gun any more than a speeding ticket should have disqualified my friend Lewis from being a doctor in Canada. But that said, that program also would have prevented somebody who had beaten or shot his wife or his friend or his dog maliciously from buying a gun. And I think that you would, I'm guessing, Billy, that you would agree with me that that's not a bad thing.
No, I have no problem with that. I don't have any problem with that.
Okay, so then we agree that speeding tickets shouldn't be part of either the gun registry or pretty much anything else other than speeding violations.
Well, I also believe that if you on the abortion issue that you brought up a little while ago, you said that this new law in Texas that we're going through right now limits abortions after 20 weeks as opposed to 24 weeks.
Correct.
And that 1.5% of abortions are
after 20 weeks.
Done in that window.
No, not in that window. After 20 weeks, period. There are abortions that are done much later than that. If you've got a mother in severe distress, she's going to die, the baby's dead. I mean, there was a woman who wrote an op-ed for the New York Times about this about 4 or 5 days ago where I think it was in the 30th week or something. Her baby just died in her uterus, in her womb, and they had to take it out or it would have killed her too. And, that was an abortion.
Right. So why?
That would be illegal now.
why are the liberals saying that this, the passing of this bill will close a certain percentage of abortion clinics in the state? And it's because they say it's going to kill their business.
No, it's not because it's going to kill their business. Because their business doesn't depend on post-20-week abortions. Most abortions are done in the first few weeks. You know, as soon as somebody discovers that they're pregnant, and you're just talking about basically removing a patch of cells that's, you know, the size of a pinhead or a little larger. What they do is they slip into these laws all these standards so that abortion clinics, you know, unlike dental clinics or unlike, you know, other kinds of basically surgical, relatively simple surgical practices, have to have standards not unlike hospitals that involve things like full anesthesia and stuff like that. And so suddenly, you know, the cost to run the abortion clinic is so high. Or the other thing is hospital privileges, admitting privileges. Many of these bills now say that state hospitals, emergency rooms, can no longer accept an emergency, a woman in crisis, if she came from an abortion clinic. So if somebody's in an abortion clinic and something goes wrong, they can't go to the hospital. Now, no abortion clinic can get insurance, and they wouldn't want to run themselves anyway if the hospital nearby can't be backup to them. And so they just go out of business. And these are the ways, I mean, these are the sneaky ways that these are sneaky, whatever you want to call it. These are the side way, rather than attacking it head on, rather than saying, let's have a conversation about at what point, you know, abortion should or shouldn't be illegal, or at what point, you know, men should be able to make the decision for women. Instead of having a law, and this is the other thing, that requires, that you get these male legislators here. You just had this situation a couple of days ago in Ohio where John Kasich and seven other men took a photo op where I believe that law, it does in many other states, mandates that if a woman wants an abortion, you know, a foot-long probe has to get shoved up her vagina to show her, you know, what her fetus looks like, or her whatever it may be. And it's like, if men had, in order to buy Viagra, if men had to have a transurethral probe, if they had to have what are those things called where they put them in so people can urinate, catheter, if a man had to be catheterized and checked out for potency before he could get Viagra, you would have men in the streets.
Okay. Now, you just said that they sneak these things in here about standards in these clinics. Now,
yeah.
On the other hand, I always hear the liberals say, well, the Republicans want to relegate women to the back alleys. Are you saying now that these clinics should not have standards?
No, they already do have standards, and they have standards that work very well. And the percentage of women who die or who are injured in abortion clinics is much lower than that in hospitals. This is not a nationwide crisis of bad abortion clinics. There have been two high-profile bad abortion doctors. Those guys committed crimes, and everybody agrees they should go to jail. And one of them is on his way. But no, it's not the case, Billy. Billy, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching us there in Texas. We'll be right back. It is 15 minutes before the hour, 45 after.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Meanwhile, worst Congress ever. We'll get into that as we continue through the day, too. Stick around.
We are about to enter another dimension. A dimension that stokes fear and ignores facts. A place so terrifying, no one should enter alone. Join us, your support group, as we enter the Right Wing Zone.
Yes, welcome to the Right Wing Zone. Here's the beer commercial. Just check this out.
Because Samuel Adams signed the Declaration of Independence, he believed there was a better way to live. All men are created equal. They are endowed with certain unalienable rights. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Okay, sounds pretty good, right? It's an ad for beer, and Sam Adams said that kind of stuff, and Sam Adams, well, we don't really know if he was religious or not. I mean, there were some of the founders, like Patrick Henry, who was very religious, other than the fact that he was the largest slaveholder in the state of Virginia, and others like you know, Tom Paine, who were openly atheist, but nobody knows about Patrick Henry. But he did, in that beer commercial, they did take out the endowed by their creator. So Fox went nuts. Here it is.
When political correctness takes over the beer advertising industry, the terrorists have won. I mean, this is absolutely outrageous.
And so there you go. Our visit for the day into the right wing zone. Don in Rockford, Illinois. We're listening to WCPT. Hey, Don, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing, buddy?
Great. What's up?
Long time listener. First time I think I've called you. I was just had a couple of comments. Billy, that was quite revealing, you know, when you were talking about the laws in the past, you know, or how bad the government is. And then he said, well, wait a minute, George Washington had three horses shot underneath him trying to preserve this government. Well, the government was good then. But, you know, so everything changes to them. How about the musket loading? You know, that's what they were allowed to have back then. Yeah. But now they think they should have automatic weapons and carry them on the street. But that wasn't my number one point. My number one point was not too long after Newtown, some wacko with a gun went in and shot some lady in the Empire State Building. Mm. The cops chased him out and shot seven innocent people trying to get him.
That's right. I remember that.
And that was, yeah. Now that's a trained individual.
Yeah, these were trained police officers who were using their own firearms that they had been for years practicing on ranges and things with. And when they tried to fire at this guy,
people popping up and getting the bad guy, not the good guy.
Yeah, and when they tried to take this guy down, they shot. I thought it was five, but Sal, I'll go with your number seven. I know that they shot a bunch of innocent bystanders, and that's not at all uncommon. It's one of the reasons why police are so reluctant to discharge their weapons.
You know, there's just no common sense whatsoever. Like, I live in Illinois, as you just said. We have a governor here that vetoed the concealed carry, you know, because they all have to have guns now. You know, every right winger in the world's got to have a gun and got to carry it. I'm 64 years old. I've hung out with Hell's Angels, Mongols, outlaws. I'm a biker. Uh-huh. Prostitutes, drug dealers. I've hung out. I've never one time ever had to have a gun. Not once.
Yeah,
and I'm not one of them, but I've hung out with them.
Yeah.
So, you know, the argument just does not hold water with me. Now, Quinn, he comes up, and he vetoes the law because he says, no, you can only carry one gun, and you can't have more than so many bullets, and you can't take them into the bar. Oh, he gutted the law. He gutted it. He gutted it. I mean,
right.
You know, we can't have... There's no common sense, you know? No.
You mean there's no common sense to the idea that people should be able to carry loaded weapons into bars?
No, that's what I'm saying. There's no common sense to the right.
I got
to
tell you.
That I should be able to have it anywhere I want to and as many as I want.
Yeah. I agree, Don, in principle. My personal take on the whole gun thing is that it should be up to states and municipalities. And while I think that every gun should be registered, licensed, the gun owners should be licensed, the gun should be registered, and both the owner and the gun should be insured. That's just my personal take on it. Whatever a state agrees to is fine with me. When I lived in Vermont, and I'm assuming the law hasn't changed, you could walk into a gun store, buy a gun, stick it in your pocket, concealed, and walk out. End of discussion. Didn't need a concealed carry permit, nothing. You know, they had probably the laxest gun laws in the United States. On the other hand, here in Washington, D.C., you've got to jump through 35 different kinds of hoops in order to get a concealed carry permit. And I respect or in New York City, too. I respect call me a tenther if you want. I respect that Tenth Amendment notion that power should be at the local level as much as possible, and that the ability of people to determine the quality of their life and how they want to live should be handled at the local level. So that's where I'm at on that. Don, thanks a lot for the call. Good comment. Excellent. Cassandra in Concord, Michigan. Hey, Cassandra.
Hi, how are you?
I am well. What's up?
Well, just as a mother of three and a responsible gun owner, I would have to agree with Kansas on this one, and I believe South Dakota as well. Both have now passed that for the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
But I would have to agree on it on the level that the students or the people that go in wanting to do these heinous crimes against children would think twice, you know, before they go in, knowing that a teacher is packing.
You know, that kid who went into Newtown was carrying an assault weapon. It could fire. Right. He could fire, you know, 30 rounds as fast as he could pull his finger 30 times. And,
oh, yeah.
And
that's one case, though. I mean, but you got these people that.
That's not just that one case. That's not uncommon. And anybody with a gun steps out and takes a shot at him, they're toast. He could take out, you know, go through walls, depending, you know, assuming that they're sheetrock.
And then you're saying that the teachers would be having it on their sides.
Well, you had out of the eight adults who were killed in that thing, six of them were killed running toward him, trying to stop him. And I would submit to you that if they had a gun in their hand, they would have been just as dead probably a second earlier.
Yeah, I mean, you can't.
And beyond that, Cassandra, maybe my experience in elementary school was different, but I remember at one point in time we had a teacher and we managed to steal her purse and spread pieces of it around the classroom. And on another occasion, we stole a condom from a male teacher out of his desk. And you know, what if it had been a gun in his desk?
On the desk. Again, no student would have access. I mean, we're talking safe now.
Well, if nobody has access to it and a guy comes barging in with a gun, he can't get it.
You know, I would have to go with Anthony on this one. I really would.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I respect your opinion, Cassandra. Thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Three countries now have apparently offered asylum to Edward Snowden, the NSA whistleblower. One of the more interesting little factoids, bits of trivia, although I haven't looked on the Financial Times website today. The last time I looked was last Wednesday, just before we left for the 4th of July holiday. But the Financial Times have been quite consistent in always referring to him as a whistleblower, whereas American corporate media was quite consistent in always referring to him as a leaker. And we had on our program last week the fellow who was arguably the leaker of the Pentagon Papers, Daniel Ellsberg, and he talked about how he went down, turned himself in, after 2 weeks, after he had published his papers in the New York Times and was released by a judge on his own recognizance at the bail hearing. The judge said, well, you know, I'm going to set bail for X, $10,000, I think it was, but I'll release you on your own signature. You seem like a fine, upstanding young man, or words to that effect. Not quite the way that Edward Snowden probably would have been dealt with. And let's go to a real expert on this. James Bamford is with us. He's a journalist. He's author. His latest book, The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. Although, let me tell you, I have read several of James Bamford's books, and this guy is a very prolific author and really, really writes brilliantly and has produced a lot of great stuff. You can see it all over at Amazon.com/James-Bamford. That's with an L, Bamford. James Bamford, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thanks, Tom. Good to be there.
Edward Snowden felt that he had to leave the United States in order to talk about what he perceived to be crimes committed by the United States. How is that in your mind and in your experience? I mean, you're a reporter on this issue, or on this broad area of how the national security industry, as it were, or agencies, react to whistleblowers. You were one yourself, arguably, or certainly a reporter. What was your experience? How has, and you've been doing this for a long, long time, for several decades anyway, I've been reading your books. And so I'm curious what your experience has been and how that has changed over the years, or what your guess is of how Edward Snowden would have been treated in the 70s or 80s or even early 90s versus today.
Well, you know, looking at it, it's probably, there wouldn't be a Edward Snowden back in those days. So we're very lucky just to get a Daniel Ellsberg. But there were very few national security whistleblowers until after 9/11, when the Bush administration began turning everything inward on the American public and so forth. So since that time, since the Bush administration, there's been more whistleblowers than I've ever seen before. And at the same time, there's been more crackdown on whistleblowers by the Obama administration than ever before. So I think there'd be a much harsher approach to any whistleblower during the Obama administration right now than there would have been in the 70s.
Okay.
So right now you've got Bradley Manning who basically had to go through some torture standing naked in a cold cell for a number of weeks or months or however long it was. That's not exactly what I would call light treatment.
Yeah. Well, and what you say raises a number of questions. The first is, do we have the Obama administration famously has prosecuted more people under the Intelligence Act? What is the name of that law?
Well, they prosecuted. You mean the
Espionage Act? Yeah.
Oh,
they have prosecuted more people under the Espionage Act than every president in history combined. So is that because there have simply been that many more whistleblowers that the excesses of the George Bush administration, which go way beyond anything, in my opinion, frankly, and I'd love to hear yours, that Nixon in his fondest dreams, I mean, his crimes were fairly narrow gauge compared to what has happened since George W. Bush's administration. Do we have more prosecutions simply because there's more whistleblowers?
Well, you have more whistleblowers, national security whistleblowers now than I think you've ever had before. But you've also got more prosecutions, so, you know, the two can go together, but also it's the fact that the Obama administration has just taken this as as one of their main, goals for the administration to prosecute whistleblowers. But it does go back, quite a ways where you've got previous whistleblowers, but there's never been this sort of draconian approach to whistleblowers that this administration has taken.
Yeah. I mean, the Deep Throat, Mark Felt, went to his grave without ever seeing a police officer, to the best of my knowledge. So where are we at, James Bamford, in this? I mean, to what extent is this entirely appropriate versus beyond the pale or somewhere in the spectrum between the two?
Well, I think the reason you're having all these whistleblowers is because you get people that, you know, learn how the American government is supposed to operate growing up in school and so forth, and then they get in and they see that everything is different. It's all operated in secret, and it's going against what they learned in high school and college and just growing up in this country. They learned that those principles that they assumed were pretty much written in stone don't apply when it comes to certain agencies like the NSA. And so I think that's what's caused a lot of these whistleblowers. I've interviewed numerous whistleblowers over the years, and particularly in the last few years. And that's pretty much been the motivation. They felt that there was a big disconnect between what they learned growing up about this country and what it stood for and what they found when they actually got into the secret rooms of the intelligence community.
Would it be reasonable to describe them as disillusioned patriots?
Well, exactly. Very disillusioned, and they're... disillusionment is to the extent that they're willing to sacrifice largely not only their careers, but perhaps their liberty by revealing this information.
Right.
I interviewed Bill Benny last year, who was a very senior official at NSA, the civilian equivalent of a general. He'd been there almost 40 years, created the entire NSA eavesdropping system overseas. And then when he saw that it was being turned inward on the American public, he quit and told me, you know, pretty much what was going on for my article in Wired. The big difference was he didn't leak any documents, and that's where you have the you know, where Edward Snowden is on the run now because it's very rare that you actually get somebody from NSA to actually walk out and leak documents.
Right, so he's both a whistleblower and a leaker, arguably.
He leaked documents, but I consider him a whistleblower because he's blowing the whistle on illegal programs.
Right.
But in order to, you know, the problem is that you have other people that said pretty much the same thing. Bill Benny talked about intercepting metadata and internet communications and all that. Hmm. And then the NSA came out and denied it and said, oh, we don't do those kind of things. We just we don't do surveillance on Americans. And, you know, what that does is encourage somebody who's in there to say, well, look, if I just go out and I blow the whistle, the NSA is just going to deny it. The only way to really prove it is to actually leak the documents.
Right, which is what Snowden did. James Bamford, always great talking with you, sir, and keep writing the brilliant books. Your most recent, The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. Thank you again for being with us, Mr. Bamford.
My pleasure, Tom.
Always great talking with you. We will be back in just a moment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So here's the question. Have we, in our terror, sacrificed so much of our liberties we can't go back? It's the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? John Roberts says they are. I say no. I don't think so. I just don't think so at all. Is it Tara or Tara in Hopland, California?
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I am well. How are you?
I'm upset, as usual, at
Uh-oh.
The situation in our country. How could I not be?
Well, channel that into some positive action, okay?
Oh, I try to as much as I can.
Good.
I was calling today about religion in the United States, but before I say that, I just have to say to Cassandra, who you spoke to earlier,
mm-hmm.
a teacher with a handgun isn't going to stop a madman with a semi-automatic weapon.
Yes.
Armed guards didn't stop Columbine, Fort Hood, or Virginia Tech, so I don't know why she thinks that putting a kindergarten teacher with a handgun is going to solve anything. And to Billy, the conservative who said that conservatives don't like government overreach, I was hoping you would say, except into women's wombs.
Yeah. Good point.
They somehow that one's okay, and they have no defense for that, except some religious mumbo jumbo. But this is a country where church and state are supposedly separate, so they really don't have any argument that's like constitutional against abortion. And do they really think that outlawing abortions are going to stop people from having them? I had a friend who almost died from drinking copious amounts of Pennyroyalty. She did abort, but she almost died.
Oh, yeah.
Too poor to get even a back alley abortion. That was her only option.
Yeah, Pennyroyal is really a nasty abortifacient. Do not try it.
It does it, but I don't recommend it.
Yeah.
And I wanted to thank you for pointing out two things I noticed that very few other people seem to be paying attention to. One is the leaker whistleblower wording that people are, you know, and I agree. Even MSNBC, even Chris Hayes is calling him a leaker,
right,
not a whistleblower. And that's distressing to
me. And it's important to me because whistleblowers have protection under UN,
right,
you know, under the UN Charter, under the Conventions of The Hague, and under U.S. law, whereas leakers don't.
Exactly. And so it's very dicey to be calling him that, especially when you consider how much the little bit of information that has come out already has changed the discussion and caused New York Times articles, and Congress is now wanting to investigate. So he's doing good stuff, and I wish people would stop think that he is, you know, they, terrorist and activist are almost equivalent in the conservative mind these days.
Tragic.
And also the media didn't report the weekend rallies. The first time I heard about it was on Democracy Now! And then you today. Nowhere.
Yeah.
I didn't hear about it at all.
Yeah.
And one other thing about that, I have a button. I make political buttons for a living, and I have a button, Police the Police. Same kind of concept. So,
yep.
Now, what I called about was to tell you, I don't know if you know that there are 316 religions in the United States. There aren't just two or three. I mean, a lot of those are like sects of Catholic or Protestant.
You mean 316, like acknowledged by the government sort of thing? Or?
Yes. If you look it up online, you can see a whole list of all the religions there are. Also, there are more atheists in this country than African Americans.
Wow.
And atheists are the most underrepresented group in Congress. I think there's one rep.
Yes.
And that
who's open about it?
Yeah, right. One person to speak out against under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. I think you've talked about it, that you remember. I remember, too. My parents were atheists, so they were flipping out when they inserted under God into the Pledge of Allegiance.
I think that was 54. I would have been 3 years old, so I don't remember that or that debate.
Yeah.
And my dad was an atheist, but I didn't know that until the year that he was dying. And we started having conversations about, you know, because my mom is was a deeply religious Christian. And my father's mother, I think, might have been Jewish and had a real mystical streak to her. And so I kind of grew up in this polyglot, but my dad, you know, he always took us to Sunday school and things because he figured, you know, A, you know, this is what mom wanted, and B, it was the 50s and 60s, and this is what you did when you raised kids, and C, you know, what harm can it do, right? And I'm actually very grateful for having grown up, you know, well exposed to religion so that I at least know what I'm talking about when I discuss religion.
Well, I'm on the exact opposite, and I'm also really grateful because my parents always made me question. And then when I took psychedelics in the 70s and changed my own mind, it was strictly my own opinion. I wasn't going with what I had been raised at all.
Yeah.
But as a child, I remember when we had to say the Pledge of Allegiance, I would mouth it so my teacher wouldn't get mad at me, but I wouldn't actually say the words under God so my parents wouldn't be upset with me.
That's interesting. I have to say, you know, I took psychedelics in the late 60s, and that experience made me not more religious but more spiritual.
Okay.
It convinced me that
I'm not into religion. I'm into spirituality.
Yeah, it convinced me that there's absolutely something way beyond what Aldous Huxley called the doors of perception. To this day, have no idea what that is, but I know it's there. And that's what I was trying to say to my dad when he was dying is, you know, you're going to go into the light. I have no idea where you're going to end up, you know, if there is a place. But this is, but anyway, I never said it very well to him, I don't think. But
yeah, I tried with my parents, you know, and I said, whether you like it or whether you believe or not, guess what?
Yeah.
This is going to happen to you.
Yeah, I think we're all part of the same collective consciousness. And my wife has this theory, the Sufi Sam's goulash theory, that, you know, when somebody's born, the great ladler in the sky takes it out of the goulash and pours it into the body. And when somebody dies, you know, we kind of dissolve back into the soup. And so our job is all to make the soup lighter. But that's not a direct, reincarnational lineage kind of thing. But, you know, anyway, lots of different theories out there. Who knows? I don't know.
We'll find out someday. It's like life's great mystery.
There you go. We will all, that's something that is absolutely, you know, death and taxes. We will all find out. Tara, thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from you. Thanks for the thoughtful commentary. We will be back. It is 27 minutes past the hour here on Anything Goes Summer on the Tom Hartman Program. And again, I want to raise this question. Have we gone too far? Stick around just a second here.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Have we gone so far since 9/11 and giving up our Fourth Amendment rights that we can't get them back? I don't think so, but maybe. Media for the sane among us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Tip of the hat to Politico, by the way. Politico.com did a very nice, it was very nice profile, I guess, of me and this show over the weekend. It came out on Saturday, as I recall. And, in fact, I have the Politico app on my iPhone, and I just popped the app open, and, whoa, there's my picture at the top. It's like, that was kind of cool. So, and I was just reading, yesterday was the day from hell in terms of travel. We left, you know, we went to Michigan for this wedding, And we left early Saturday, Sunday morning, and we got home last night about midnight because our plane was delayed. First of all, we had a 2-hour layover in Chicago, and then our plane got delayed for like 4 hours. And it was just, it was, you know, one of, and then we had to fly into Baltimore, and so we had to get an Amtrak train to come to Union Station. And then, you know, it just, it, whew. And so anyhow, and on the app, you can't read the comments. And so today, during the break, I'm reading the comments, and this is, the comments are almost as good as the article. So anyhow, get over to politico.com if you're curious about it. It's, I think it's kind of scrolled, I scrolled off the front page now, but you just type Hartman into the search thing and it'll pop right up. So just, you know, for what it's worth. Brooke in Palco, Kansas. Hey, Brooke, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk to you about the Kansas legislation, about the gun control laws that they passed.
Mm-hmm. You mean arming teachers that the insurance companies are now saying, not so much.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So they actually are not going to arm the teachers. The teachers have the right to make that decision on their own, whether they will carry. They will not advertise that they're carrying. It is a concealed carry.
Yeah, no, I understand
that. So the students themselves, will not know which teacher is carrying or not.
Yeah, if we were able to steal Mr. Clark's condom, I think that we could have gotten his gun if he had one.
You know, I'm going to say that I support the law. I support the law because I believe that most Kansans do. You know, they are very conservative out there. Most of the teachers are avid gun owners and hunters themselves.
Yeah.
Including my sister-in-law, who is a teacher in Palco, Kansas, or was anyway. She decided to take a business route with a master's degree in business. But my point is that arming teachers is not going to come to the harm of the student. Teachers are put there for a reason. You know, if they're not of sound mind, they're going to start shooting students. They shouldn't be a teacher anyway. You know, all teachers get angry, but it should be up to the principal of whether or which teachers can carry and can't. You know, like, you know, and if he knows that there's a problem with a teacher, that, you know, maybe you shouldn't carry a gun. Maybe he shouldn't be a teacher.
Yeah. I don't disagree with that logic, although I still hold strongly to the opinion that guns in places where there's lots of children is not a good combination. And if the gun is sufficiently secure that no child can get to it, then when some guy kicks in the door with an AR-15 spraying bullets around, that teacher's not going to be able to get to the gun anyway, number one. And number two, I've actually been in and on the edges of war zones. I was in Uganda in 1980 during the civil war with Idi Amin. We took over the Namalo prison farm. We took over a refugee center. A woman that I was working with, a Red Cross worker, and for the Red Cross, was shot and killed by a sniper. And I can tell you that when you're under fire, all bets are off. People do not make rational decisions. They unless they have been under fire a lot, you know, and then they're, you know, look at, you know, people coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan who've been under fire a lot. They are badly wounded by it themselves. They come back with post-traumatic stress disorder. It is, I just can't imagine a second grade teacher having the wherewithal to take a concealed weapon out of its appropriately concealed and well-secured place so that when that teacher goes to the bathroom, the kids can't get it, and pulling that gun out and using it against somebody who's just kicked in the door and is spraying bullets around.
There are several places that they could keep them on their body that they'd be concealed that would not take more than a second to get to, as in the waistband of the back of your pants, as in a leg holster down on your ankle. That would be covered by pants.
Then you've got a gun where it could conceivably fall to the ground, where it could be accidentally discharged, where a kid could snatch it as you walk by. I think that the cost, if you look at it just in the, there may be one case where a school shooter is stopped by an armed teacher. But the cost-benefit ratio in my mind is not worth it.
Isn't that what Biden said, is if we can save one life?
Not if you're going to lose 20 or 30 on the way.
I'll tell you what, is that when an AR-15 is a semi-automatic, most of your handguns are semi-automatic. You can squeeze off bullets just as fast with a handgun than you can with a AR-15.
Yeah, you're just limited by your clip size.
Yes.
By your magazine size.
Well, that's right. But guess what? You know how fast you can change a 9mm handgun? Seconds.
Well, just looking over, if you're really good and if you're really fast, yes. Looking over just what happened over the last week. In Howland Township, Ohio, Edward has been sitting in his home. His sister-in-law, Barbara Leary, has been house-sitting. Boom, a bullet goes through the wall. It was James Carr of Doofus Road told officers he and his stepson have been shooting into a pile of wood in the backyard. They didn't realize that the bullet went through this guy's house. The next day, Richfield in Minnesota, one weapons offense call on June 14th about a 32-year-old intoxicated woman. Merced, California. These are too long for me to read you all this stuff, but here we have, I have in front of me, in my hot little hands, 48 accidental shootings that happened over the weekend. 48 accidental shootings. These are, every single one of these people was a responsible gun owner who thought, ain't never going to happen to me. And out of those 48 accidental shootings, 12 children ages 3, 6, 6, 7, 9, 11, 11, 15, 16, 16, 17, and 17 died. And none of these involved the stereotyped, it must have been gangbangers or that kind of thing. None of them.
Okay, wait. Was those shootings, the one that was in the backyard where it went into somebody else's house, is that within city limits?
No, it's in Howland Township, Ohio. I'm guessing it's out in the country. The guy's out in the backyard firing a handgun and a shotgun into a wood pile. He's probably in a more rural area. But
Not necessarily. A lot of towns and houses have wood piles for fireplaces. But within city limits, it's illegal anyway. But you look at Chicago. How many people, name over this last weekend, how many people, or the holiday, how many people have got shot there?
Yeah, it 74. Was, it was 74. A substantial number.
That's right. Now, Chicago has gun bans.
Yeah, I agree. Chicago also has massive inequality between the rich and the poor. When you look at, and the people who really did the brilliant research on this were Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkinson, and they wrote two books about it. One's called Why Inequality Matters, and the other's called The Spirit Level. Their website is equalitytrust.org.uk. And what they found was that the number of guns is not the highest predictor of gun violence. The availability of guns is not the highest predictor of gun violence. The highest predictor of gun violence is inequality in a society.
But those people have every opportunity, just as I moved out of my parents' house, and while my parents worked very hard, my dad is a truck driver, my mother is the president of a bank in Colorado, in Denver, that we were, we had things that we needed. They never gave us everything that we needed, but when I moved out, I was the brokest of broke. I lived off ramen noodles. I opened up those doors and I walked through them to provide myself what I'm doing today.
Yeah, and I'm guessing you're white.
Everybody has, huh?
And I'm guessing you're white.
It doesn't matter whether I'm white. I'm a truck.
It actually does.
I actually haul, I haul oil up in North Dakota. I am the minority up here. Do you know how many women are hauling oil doing what I'm doing? I've seen two. So I am a minority up here. It is 50-1 odds of women to men up here.
Okay.
So I open those doors. I made my own. I don't put up with anybody's crap of that I cannot do this because I'm a woman.
But the fact of the matter is, Brooke, if we want to take our conversation away from the conversation of, should there be guns in schools and will accidents happen, and I think, yes, they will, but you think, no, they won't, we'll respect each other's disagreement. If you want to take that to a discussion of inequality in the United States, what we have seen since Reaganomics is that the wealth of the top 1% has grown to the point where 400 people own more wealth than the other, than the bottom half of America. And just massive wealth inequality, where the average CEO, when I was a kid in the 50s and 60s, made 30 times what their employees made. And these are the well-off CEOs. I lived in a neighborhood where my dad worked in a tool and die shop, and the neighbor behind me was a dentist. Those things have spread apart. And this is a $13,000 house my dad bought in 56. That is how far it has, our society has. And in fact, the guy I was showing our kids over the weekend, the guy who had the house two houses down from us, who was the rich guy in the neighborhood because he could afford a garage, he owned the local carpet store. He was a small businessman. And, you know, nowadays it's like we are the rich and the poor. We are the rich and the working poor. And the middle class is increasingly vanishing. And this is 32 years of Reaganomics. It's devastating America. And I think that it bears a relationship to why there's that much gun violence in Chicago and other parts of the United States. But, Brooke, I'm sorry we're out of time. I appreciate the reasonable and rational conversation. Thank you very much for calling and for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. We'll talk again, I'm sure. Thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, and by the way, how do you cure inequality as a systemic cultural problem? You do what every other developed country in the world does. You raise the top income tax rate above 50%. Let's check in with the Talk Ready News Service, find out what's going on in the world today. This Talk Ready News Report brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.org, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped. GoatsForTheOldGoat.org. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So, what's going on in the world?
Well, I was at the White House press briefing a couple of hours ago, and Jay Carney, the press secretary, said that the White House is calling on all sides in Egypt to refrain from violence and return to democracy, but he did say that we think it would not be in our best interest to cut off aid. We are going to examine this and monitor this and take the time necessary in making the determination in a manner that's consistent with our policy objectives and our national security interests. And that statement referred both to cutting off aid and in determining whether a military coup d'etat has taken place.
Right, and the rationale, I'm assuming, behind this, Egypt being one of the three largest recipients of U.S. foreign aid, is which kicked up as a consequence of the Egypt-Israeli peace agreements during the Carter administration. The my guess for the rationale behind this is that if we cut off aid, an already struggling economy with a 30%, 35% inflation rate and you know high unemployment in Egypt is going to get a lot worse really fast, and that's going to super empower the crazies, and that's the last thing we should be doing right now.
I think that is a major consideration. However, he did not say that.
Right.
I think he felt it was prudent not to give a rationale.
Yeah, I agree. Although John McCain is out there saying cut off their aid, I don't get it. I don't, you know, is
he is out there saying that. And there are other lawmakers saying that. There are other lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats, Lamar Alexander, for example, or is it Bob Corker? No, I think it's Bob Corker, actually, saying it's not time to cut off aid, actually.
Right. Right.
But John McCain saying we should be cutting off aid. Also saying the United States is not taking sides. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood, in the wake of the shooting today outside the barracks, where ex-President Morsi is believed to be being held, and the shooting which is being investigated, and who knows what that will turn up, and we don't know what the origin of that shooting was yet, but at least 51 people were killed, about 300 wounded. Many of them were Muslim Brotherhood members around 4 a.m. Muslim Brotherhood is calling for protests tomorrow. So I think that I wouldn't be being a psychic if I predicted that there will be bloodshed in Egypt tomorrow.
Yeah, this is genuinely tragic.
It's genuinely tragic, genuinely tragic. Also, as a consequence of the shooting, and this is politically highly significant, the hardline Salafist Nur Party, which had supported Morsi's removal, said it was withdrawing from talks to choose an interim prime minister, and it described the shooting incident as a massacre. Now, it was the Salafist Nur Party which nixed the appointment of Mohamed El-Baradei, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, as the prime minister over the weekend.
Right, and if we were to try to draw American parallels, you could say Morsi was sort of like Ralph Reed or Jerry Falwell being elected president of the United States and, you know, tilting the country in a more Islamist direction or a more Christian, if you would, in the United States. But the Salafists are like the Westboro Baptist Church.
Well, they're certainly very, very hard line, but they did align themselves with those who were in favor of ousting Morsi, and the hope was...
Because he wasn't radical enough for them.
Right. The hope was to keep them on board, but clearly the whole thing's fractured now, and the whole thing is really messed up.
Yeah, it's very interesting, really, though, to see the whole right wing, if you want to call it that, the whole Islamist wing, but I think it's right wing. I think right wing is an accurate description of it, the authoritarian wing of the Egyptian political world turning upon itself.
It is very interesting indeed. San Francisco fire officials acknowledged today that one of their trucks responding to the Asiana Airlines crash at San Francisco airport may have run over one of the two teenage girls killed in the accident.
Yeah, another sad tragedy.
And
you know, a lot of airlines now count simulator time as real time when they say, you know, this pilot has 300 hours in the cockpit of this particular aircraft. This guy had, 44 hours in the cockpit of a 777?
Yeah, 43 hours.
And
yeah.
I wonder how many of those hours were in a simulator. I mean, is it?
Well, if they followed global standards, the majority would have been in a global simulator.
That is scary. And I'm a pilot myself. I mean, you've got this old-fashioned lighting system where you've got red lights and white lights that are halfway down the runway, and you kind of keep yourself, you know, shooting right down between the lights, and you make a decent landing. Landing an airplane is not rocket science. I mean, it's a challenge and it's difficult, and this is a great big airplane, and they didn't have the glide slope working. The instrument landing system was partially disabled. The glide slope was turned off. But wow, I'm just, you know, how could the guy in the right hand seat, the guy who was with him, have let this happen?
I don't know. Now, Deborah Herzman, the NTSB chief, also said Monday, you and I have been talking about this, while weather has been ruled out as a factor, other factors they're investigating do include whether construction at the airport may have played a role. And she did say that work to extend a runway safety area did require the temporary shutdown of a system designed to help pilots land planes safely. Right. And she specifically mentioned that.
Yeah. Is there any indication that that might have been slowed down, or that the process is taking more time as a consequence of the sequester?
There has been no mention of that.
Be an interesting question to ask in a White House press briefing.
It would be an interesting question to ask. I don't think they would necessarily know the answer, but it would be a very interesting question to ask if one got the opportunity to ask that question. Yes.
Indeed.
U.S. federal judge said today she can't halt the force feeding of hunger-striking prisoners at Guantanamo. She also said the practice appears to violate international law.
Wait a minute. She said she can't stop it, but it's against the law?
It appears to violate international law.
Which we have to subscribe, we have to follow, do we not?
Yes, she said she lacks jurisdiction to stop it, but she also said Barack Obama, the president, probably has the power to address the issue.
Wow. That's amazing. Victoria Jones, you've always got gems for us. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, the New York Times has a great op-ed, or not an op-ed, it's solid news reporting piece today, about how incompetent the 113th Congress is. Now, some people, you say the 113th Congress, they go, what are you talking about? Here's how it works. Every 2 years, a new Congress is sworn in. And the current Congress is the 113th Congress that's been sworn in since the George Washington presidency. And it's well on its way to setting a very, very undesirable record. The current do-nothing Congress, seriously, they're on track to pass fewer bills. And it's not like, you know, lots of bills means good Congress, a lot of few bills means bad. It's nothing like that, but there are things that need to be done. Right? They're on track to pass fewer bills than the 112th do-nothing Congress of 2 years ago, which passed the fewest number of bills signed into law since record-keeping began back in the 40s, which means they even beat the Do-Nothing Congress of that Harry Truman ran against of 1946 to 48, or 47 to 49, technically. Right now, the 113th Congress has a pile of legislation yet to be considered. Everything is student loans. You know, they didn't do anything about it. So on July 1st, student loan rates doubled. Immigration reform, the Senate has passed a bill. The House of Representatives, which is controlled by the Republicans, we don't care about that. Post office reform, back in 2006, when the post office was talking about solarizing and electrifying their vehicle fleet. They got the largest vehicle fleet in the United States. They are the largest unionized employer in the United States. They were making a great profit. They were doing great. So in 2006, the Bush administration, the Republicans in Congress said, we can't have that. And they slipped in this little thing that says that the post office had to put $10 billion a year aside to pay for the retirement health benefits of people who are retiring 75 years from now, who are not yet even born. And then on top of that, you got the debt limit. Last time Congress ignored the debt limit, what happened? Our debt rating went down. Gets ignored altogether. Well, frankly, you know, what's going to happen? I think that the president should. I doubt he will. Because this would require, you know, standing up and speaking out and taking names and kicking ass, and that's just not his style. But what he should do is he should say, this whole debt limit thing is a violation of the full faith and credit clause of the 14th Amendment. It is unconstitutional. Therefore, I'm going to ignore it. And I'm going to direct the Treasury Department, which works for me in the executive branch, to keep paying the bills. That's what I think he should do. But in any case, don't expect this latest and greatest rendition of the Do-Nothing Congress to get around to doing any of that stuff anytime soon. Because since the 113th Congress took over Capitol Hill in January, they've only passed 15 bills that were signed into law by President Obama. Now, to put that in perspective, that's eight fewer than in the first 6 months of the 112th Congress, a whopping 19 fewer bills than in the first 6 months of the 111th Congress. And of those 15 bills that were passed and signed into law, most of them were pretty irrelevant. Unless you consider, quote, the size of the precious metal blank that will be used in the production of the National Baseball Hall of Fame Canadair coins, end quote, as an issue of urgent national importance. So how do we get to the point in Washington where Congress can't manage to pass legislation of urgent importance, like keeping student loan debts from doubling in price, in interest rates? But instead they pass a bill addressing coinage instantly. This all started, you can track this whole thing, back to January 20th, 2009. It was a night when most people in Washington, D.C. were out celebrating the start of the Obama presidency. It was the day he had been sworn in, Inauguration Day. And that night, Ellen Ratner got me a ticket to go to the, I think it was the Silver Ball, whichever one it was in Union Station, and I was there with Ellen and a few hundred of our closest friends. And President Obama and his wife came out and danced, and Joe Biden and his wife came out and danced. But while we were dancing with the president and the vice president, there was this small group of Republican lawmakers who were plotting the end of the Obama presidency, the day that it began, before it had really even begun. On that night at the Caucus Room restaurant here in Washington, D.C., Republican leaders on Capitol Hill were plotting to intentionally sabotage and undermine the Obama presidency at every chance possible. Robert Draper writes about this in his book, Do Not Ask What Good We Do. Here's the who's who of Republican power players in Washington who are at the meeting. On the guest list for the four-hour invitation-only meeting were Republican Congressman Eric Cantor, Paul Ryan, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, and Republican Senators Jim DeMint, who now runs the Heritage Foundation, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker. The whole thing was orchestrated by Republican propaganda mastermind Frank Luntz, and Newt Gingrich was also in attendance. In fact, on this show, just a few months ago, I asked him about this, and he flat out admitted that the purpose of the dinner meeting was to come up with a plan to sabotage the Obama presidency. Hear that clip, Shane? And you were quoted in the book as saying that after this dinner, you'll remember this as the day the seeds of 2012 were sown. Is that all accurate?
Well, in part.
So were you guys insurgents against the Obama presidency?
Well, the fact is, look, the opposition party ought to sit down and try to figure out how to get back in power. Mm-hmm. That's why they're the opposition party. If they're not going to try to get back in power, they might as well switch parties and join the incumbent party.
So during the dinner, the Republican lawmakers vowed to bring Congress to an absolute standstill, regardless of how badly that would hurt the already hurting American economy or the American people, by pledging to obstruct, filibuster, and block any legislation that President Obama wanted. And while the meeting at the caucus room was top secret, Republican attendees at that meeting were very frank just a couple months later about what had transpired. Congressman Pete Sessions told the National Journal in March of 2009 that the Republican sabotage plan was all about following the tactics of the Taliban. Yeah, the terrorist organization. Sessions said that Taliban insurgency, this is a verbatim quote, Taliban insurgency, we understand perhaps a little bit more because of the Taliban. Insurgency is the way they went about systematically understanding how to disrupt and change a person's entire processes. And these Taliban are an example of how you go about to change a person from their messaging to their operations to their frontline message. And we need to understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with the other side. That would be the Democrats. Texas congressman went on to say, if the Democrats do not give us those options or opportunities, then we will become insurgency. I think insurgency is a mindset and an attitude that we're going to have to search for and find ways to get our message out and to be prepared to see things for what they are rather than trying to do something about them. And that Taliban-like insurgency is working. Every one of the lawmakers that attended that caucus room dinner has since threatened a government shutdown at one time or another. During the 2011 debt ceiling negotiations, caucus room attendees Congressman Eric Cantor and Senator John Kyle walked out of the negotiations. As a result of the intentional negotiation collapse, America's credit rating was lowered. Since that January 2009 dinner, Senators Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker have helped to filibuster more bills than during any other Congress combined in history. They even filibustered Al Franken's anti-rape amendment. Amazing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
These guys were so intent on destroying the Obama presidency that they would filibuster anti-rape legislation. Senators Jim DeMint, Tom Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker have filibustered more than 300 bills. That's more than any other Congress in history combined. They voted no on every single piece of legislation brought to the floor, including Al Franken's anti-rape amendment, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, the Lilly Ledbetter Law, the Fair Pay Act. There was an anti-outsourcing bill in 2010. They filibustered that. Representatives Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Representative Peter Sessions, Jeb Henseling, Pete Kutzer, Dan Lundgren voted no on every single piece of legislation, including no to increase FEMA funding during natural disasters. During natural disasters. It's mind-boggling. They did vote yes for everything Bush and Cheney wanted. They voted yes to bail out Bear Stearns. Now, this is back when Bush was president, Cheney was vice president. They voted yes to bail out Bear Stearns. They voted yes to bail out AIG. They voted yes to the 2008 stimulus. They voted yes to TARP in 2008 in September. They voted yes for the second TARP in 2008 in October. They were fine to give money to the banksters and spend money and could pass out money when you had a Republican president. But when a Democrat came in, not so much. They supported Bush-Cheney in keeping both wars off the budget. They supported Bush-Cheney spending $4 trillion while giving tax cuts to the top 1%. They refused to negotiate or even discuss passing President Obama's Americans Jobs Act, which would have created 1.3 million jobs. No, that never happened because the Republicans wouldn't allow it to happen. This is just incredible. And then, as I, you know, you heard Newt Gingrich say, you'll remember this as the day the seeds of 2012 were sown. Keep in mind, this was 2009. This was Inauguration Day. And Newt Gingrich said, this is the day, this is the strategy that we're going to employ to make Obama a one-term president. And then Mitch McConnell in there going, yeah, my job is to make Barack Obama a one-term president. Now, how can these guys claim to be patriots? How can they claim to be to love this country if they're willing to hold the working people of America? I mean, you know, this in 2010, there was legislation passed that said to companies, you no longer get a tax break when you offshore outsource jobs. It didn't say you can't do it. It just said we're no longer going to subsidize it. No more tax breaks for it. It passed the House of Representatives back when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker. And then it got to the Senate. And these senators, Jim DeMint, DeJohn Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, Bob Corker, opposed it. It got filibustered and died. A bill to stop the tax break. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. Jeff in Washington, D.C., you ask, isn't rape already illegal? Seriously?
Yeah, well, I'm not familiar with the Al Franken Amendment. Refresh me on that, and maybe I'll, you know, just, I didn't know. I just caught the end of your, you know, your last statement as you went into commercial or whatever. So what was his amendment?
Yeah, I'm sorry I don't have the details of it in front of me. My recollection is that it provided more assistance to victims of rape and made it easier for women to report rape. That's right. It was military contractors. This was after that woman came forward who worked for one of the military contractors in Iraq who had been raped, reported the rape, and she was locked. She was nailed into a wooden box for a couple of days. Remember that? The Al Franken piece of legislation would have allowed women who were employees of military contractors to have a venue, a vehicle, because she was not in the United States, so she couldn't call on U.S. law, and she was not in the military, so she couldn't call on the U.S. Code of Military Justice. So the only person she could talk to was her employer. And her employer, the people who worked for her employer, her chain of command in the company, nailed her into a box to keep her from talking. And so Al Franken's bill would have given her the right to use U.S. law to charge her rapist with rape, which she did not have because she was overseas. She was in Iraq.
But then I wouldn't have any problem with that. I just thought maybe it was some innocuous.
Yeah, you wouldn't have had a problem with it, but John Kyle and Jim DeMint and Tom Coburn and John Ensign and Bob Corker, they all had a problem with it. Those five Republican senators who were at that meeting.
Was there anything else attached to that legislation?
Nope.
But either way, I would agree that somebody attacked overseas, a U.S. citizen, should have recourse rather than just reporting to her employer who may be complicit in the act.
That's my point. This has nothing to do with what's good legislation or bad legislation. This, you know, during normal times, Republicans would be, you know, all over. In fact, you know, Republicans historically have been all over protectionist legislation, you know, legislation that says to transnational corporations, we're not going to subsidize your offshoring jobs. During the Eisenhower administration and during the Nixon administration, it was Republicans who were, you know, champions. Democrats were talking about free trade. It was Bill Clinton who signed NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO. A lot of Republicans were objecting to it, although George Herbert Walker Bush wasn't. But there was a lot of good legislation that came out, but they were just saying no to everything because they wanted Obama to have a failed presidency, and they're still doing it.
Yeah, and when Democrats are in power and the opposing party holds the White House,
when Democrats are in power, they pass good legislation, even Republican good legislation.
They also thwarted a number of, you know, when Bush was trying to get the the banking regulations tightened up because of all the bad, you know, bank loans and everything, then the opposing party thwarted that, you know, Barney Frank and Nancy Pelosi.
Can you identify a piece of legislation that did that? Because I have no recollection of that. My recollection is that, you know, Phil Graham, the Republican, whose wife Wendy was on the board of Enron, was the champion of Graham Leach Bliley and of the Commodities Futures Modernization Act. He wrote both those bills that did away with
Bliley
Glass-Steagall.
I deal with Graham Leach Bliley every day, and I'm in the real estate business, and that wasn't a good bill either.
All right, yeah. Well, there you go. That's Phil Graham. Jeff, thanks for the call. Good talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So the big question in my mind is, why is it that when the media reports on Republican obstruction, they don't reference this January 20th, 2009 meeting where it was planned? The bad and the very, very scatophagously ugly. The good. The Sacramento Food Bank. While new CEO Blake Young took over until new CEO Blake Young took over 5 years ago, the California Capital's food bank wasn't that different from many other distribution centers across our country. Despite the generosity of its donors, it mostly served processed fare like white bread and salty store-bought macaroni and cheese to its many hungry customers. Now, thanks to Young's keen leadership, the Sacramento Food Bank has shaken things up by working with local organic farmers to bring fresh produce to its distribution centers. The new initiative is called the Farm to Fork Program, and according to city residents, has drastically improved the health of the food bank's beneficiaries. Good work, Sacramento Food Bank. Everyone, especially the poorest among us, deserves access to organic, fresh, and nutritious food. The bad. Donnie Spell. The North Carolina farmer's under fire this week after he drove a float in the Hope Mills 4th of July parade last week that featured a Confederate flag and a sign painted with the phrase, "White History Month. Hug white people." The float, which you can see wherever you look, it's on the TV screen for those of you watching TV, was, according to parade regulations, supposed to have a sign advertising watermelons for sale. But Farmer Spell apparently had other more rebellious ideas. Because, you know, nothing says celebrating American democracy like flying the flag of the secessionist movement dedicated to the preservation of slavery and the end of the Union. And the very, very ugly Chris Koster. The Missouri Attorney General wants to bring back gas chambers. Seriously, he does. Koster told the Associated Press last week that because his state's death row has become so backlogged by appeal litigation and a scant supply of lethal injection drugs, it might be time to resort to drastic measures, executing condemned inmates with poisonous gas. Despite what the Attorney General says, using poisonous gas will not be more efficient. Missouri hasn't executed anyone that way since the 1960s, and rebuilding gas chambers would cost the state a tidy sum of money. It would also be just plain immoral. Gas executions can take as long as 10 minutes and are extremely painful. The death penalty is bad enough, but Attorney General Koster's plan to reintroduce Holocaust-style state murder to Missouri? Well, that's just very, very ugly. Jeez. Taking a page from Adolf Hitler? Really? Really? Well, it is. He's a Republican. What can you say? Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. What was I going to say?
You were going to say something about the Second Amendment.
It was something about, the guy in the first hour, Billy, who was tired of all of the federal regulation on guns. I guess it was something he was talking about that.
Right.
Unfortunately, the fact that it exists in the Constitution, the Second Amendment, that talks about guns, means that it's necessary that the federal government will have some part in it, if nothing more than nine politicians in robes deciding what it means, since we have Marbury v. Madison in 1803.
Right, and those nine politicians have decided at least three different things over the years with regard to guns.
And so, he's going to have to put up with that. And this is what, Tom, I was going to bring this up with you a few months ago, but I've come around to the way of thinking of some other pinko communists like Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, that the Bill of Rights is actually a Bill of Wrongs. They were two guys who didn't want the Bill of Rights, and if you want to read Federalist Paper 84, where Hamilton argues against the Bill of Rights,
yep,
having a Bill of Rights, and of course Madison, when drafting them, called it the nauseating process of amendments,
yeah,
you can see that the Ten Amendments, every single one of the Ten Amendments in the Bill of Rights, has come before the Supreme Court at least once since 1919. Three times, the First Amendment, and actually, Hamilton actually addresses the freedom of the press. He says, what in the H does that mean?
Right.
Somebody's going to have to decide, and it turns out it's the nine guys in robes.
Right.
In 1919, we had the Schenck, the Debs, and the Abrams cases, and in 1927, we had the Gitlow case, all in First Amendment, and in my opinion, the court ruled wrongly in all four cases, and they've ruled wrongly in every one of the Ten Amendments in the Constitution.
When did the Third Amendment, you can't quarter soldiers in your home, when did that come before the court?
Okay, maybe not that one.
Okay. Right. I just, you know, I never knew that that was an issue, but, you know, it could be. But I get your point. I get your point. And so are you now saying that, first of all, with regard to the Bill of Rights, the Bill of Rights was something that basically Thomas Jefferson shoved down James Madison's throat.
Well, it was a compromise. The Southern states weren't going to they weren't going to ratify the Constitution without some declaration of rights.
Right.
And of course, Hamilton and Madison didn't want one, and it was finally the 16th paper of the Federal Farmer that argued it couldn't do any harm, and it would serve to demonstrate the spirit of the Constitution and that just because they weren't enumerated, we have the Ninth Amendment that says all rights not mentioned here are reserved to the people.
Right.
But the point I'm trying to make is, since it's in the Constitution, it is subject at least to the Supreme Court via Marbury v. Madison, and what it's really done is it's taken the power out of the hands of the people.
Yeah.
In other words, these gun cases, we could have legislation in any given state that could take care of this gun legislation and not have to stand for Nino Scalia's interpretation.
But, Paul, that's not a problem with the existence or non-existence. And I can argue it both sides. And let's just very quickly encapsulate that argument for our listeners, okay? The argument that was made against the Bill of Rights being attached to the Constitution was that once you start specifying what rights people have, then anything else is not considered a right. It's considered a privilege. And now you have narrowly circumscribed the rights of the American people. And we're not going to think of everything. And times will change as time goes on.
Right.
And that would be a mistake. I mean, that was the argument that Madison made and that Hamilton made. On the other hand, the argument that Jefferson made was that, Jefferson and Mason and a few others who were on his side, was that if we don't explicitly say at least a few things, and
right,
Jefferson's original, if you read his original, it was Christmas Eve of 1787, December 24, 1787, he wrote the letter to Madison in which he laid out his first draft of the Bill of Rights and said that he would, and he was living in Paris at the time, and said he would lobby the Virginia delegation to not ratify the convention if it was not included. And it wasn't
right
included at the time of ratification, but it was promised, and everybody kept their word back then. But he said that the Bill of Rights should say that there shall be an absolute right to a free press. There shall be an absolute right to a trial by jury, that there shall be no monopolies in commerce. That never made its way into the Bill of Rights. And there was one other thing I don't remember. Oh, yeah, and there shall be no standing armies during time of peace. There was a fifth thing that he mentioned. I forget what it was. But the standing armies during times of peace and the no monopolies in commerce actually never made their way into the Bill of Rights. And had they made their way into the Bill of Rights, I mean, the closest they got was, you know, the compromise that Madison gave Jefferson on this was they wrote into the Constitution in Article 1, Section 8, that no appropriation of money by Congress can last more than 2 years for the military. You know, you can appropriate money for a century for anything else, but no, you know, this is why they have to reauthorize the the military budget every year, basically.
That was part of what was, I think, is it correct that the Virginia Declaration of Rights is what the prototype that Madison started with, and then he ended up with a list of 17 that then got pared down to 12.
Yep.
And then the first two got booted because they were so...
Yeah, and the Virginia Declaration of Rights, Jefferson played a big hand in. So you had, you know, on the one hand, Jefferson saying, we've got to nail down at least some things, and he didn't even get everything that he wanted. And then on the other hand, you had Hamilton saying, wait a minute, if you nail down some things, then that's going to give future governments and future courts the ability to say everything else is off the table. Which has largely happened. But your thing with the Supreme Court, if your objection is to Scalia's interpretation of the Second Amendment, you know, finding a personal right in, you know, the Heller case or whatever it was, to own a gun in the Second Amendment, that's an argument against judicial review, not an argument against the Bill of Rights.
Well, it could be both. But my point is this, to finish my point.
Go for it.
To Billy is that he's, because of the fact that it says there is a Second Amendment that has to do with the gun ownership. He's in the Army, so to speak, that we're going to have federal intervention in gun rights. That's the way it is. There's a flip side of every coin, and that the Second Amendment not only guarantees some rights, but it also puts some things on the table that he might not like. Whereas he's sick of government. He's going to have to put up with some government, and the plenary power of the state is one he cannot escape.
Right.
So, you know, he's going to have to deal with what some government somewhere. To quote E.E. Cummings, you cannot live your own life. So there you go, Billy.
Okay, Paul, a good rejoinder. Thank you very much for the call. Well said. And I think you're absolutely right. This is the thing that, you know, ever since Reagan said government is not the solution, government is the problem. People have been, you know, glomming onto this bumper sticker like there was some deep truth in it. And it's not what the founders thought. I mean, the founders, those 56 people who signed the Declaration of Independence, literally committed treason. They literally put their, or they metaphorically put their heads in the noose the moment they signed that document, because they believed in government. Self-government, but government.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And it's so sad and tragic that instead of saying good government, bad government, you know, big government, small government, we're not saying good government, bad government. Welcome back, Tom Hartman. Here with you 10 minutes before the hour. And Charles in Montgomery, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Okay. Hey, Charles, you're on the air. What's up?
Hi, Tom. About a year ago, there was a shooting in Times Square, and the gunman shot one person, and there were two police officers. They shot like six people accidentally.
Right. Yeah, this happens.
Here's the biggest argument.
Yeah, this is, you know, I really think that the people who think that arming a second grade teacher or fifth grade teacher or whatever is somehow going to magically protect that teacher and their students from some crazed killer with an AR-15 and a 50-round clip is, you know, they've just been watching too many movies. They, you know, it's the old John Wayne, you point the gun, you pull the trigger, it goes bang, and the person falls over dead. A, usually people miss when they shoot. B, when they do hit somebody, 9 times out of 10, they don't hit with a kill hit, and instead you get the person shrieking and screaming and flopping around on the floor, bleeding all over the place, and, you know, life is just not as nice and tidy as in the cartoons.
Yep. And there was a study, actually several studies by law enforcement that determined that, you know, accuracy of police in shooting under stressful situations is compromised.
Certainly.
So if police who are trained for it can't do it, what makes you think that a...
third grade teacher can do it. And on top of that, these are the same Republicans who say, these third grade teachers, they make too much money. They're union thugs, right? They want to arm the union thugs, really?
And then, that might be a good idea, though.
There you go. Okay. Charles, I'm not going to touch that one. Thanks a lot for the call. Alan in Gardendale, Illinois, or Alabama, excuse me. Alan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Have you heard of the 13th century Sufi poet Rumi?
Oh, yeah. I've read Rumi. Rumi was a mystic, a brilliant, brilliant. He wrote love poems to God, basically. Yes.
Okay. Well, I sent some of his poems to Don Siegelman in prison,
mm-hmm.
and they were rejected by a prison official.
Really?
Can you believe that?
No, I'm astounded. I've written letters to Don Siegelman, and he's responded to me.
Uh-huh. I just can't figure out what is wrong with Rumi. I never thought of him as a threat to anybody.
Yeah. Maybe they thought it was some kind of secret code to how Karl Rove's involvement in Don Siegelman being railroaded. I don't know, Alan. You might want to send a note to the warden of that prison asking what the deal is. For people who don't know what Alan and I are talking about, Governor Don Siegelman, Democratic governor of Alabama, was railroaded, basically. He was sent to jail by Karl Rove's best friend after he ran against Bob Riley, the Republican who was running against him for governor of Alabama, whose campaign was being run by Karl Rove's best friend's wife. Excuse me, by Karl Rove's best friend, and Karl Rove's best friend's wife, Lura Canary, was the federal prosecutor, and during the Bush administration, she then prosecuted Don Siegelman when he started yelling about how Karl Rove might have been involved in voter fraud. And so Karl Rove got him thrown into the clink and thrown into solitary confinement and all kinds of god-awful things. And if you want to learn all about it, go to free-don.com or .org. It'll get you there. Or donsiegelman.org, I before E. And there's one N in Siegelman. And his story, I mean, 60 Minutes did an expose on it. I've had him on this show a number of times. He's a political prisoner right now. He's back in prison. And for doing something that any other politician in America not only would not get punished for, but probably would get a medal for, trying to get more money for education in the schools in Alabama and trying to get a lottery going. But Ralph Reed and Jack Abramoff didn't like that, and Karl Rove didn't like the fact that Don Siegelman called out his tactics. I mean, they found 15,000 votes in the middle of the night in a Republican precinct on a Republican-run voting machine, and that's the only reason Bob Riley, quote, won the election. After it had already been called for Don Siegelman, and when he started yelling about it in the press, all of a sudden, the Bush administration's Justice Department is all over him. Anyhow, check out free-don.com. Alan, let us know what, you know, if you get a hold of the warden, what they have to say. Thanks for the call. Rumi's poetry is beautiful, by the way. Kelly in Lake Havasu City, Arizona. Hey, Kelly, you know something about the Third Amendment?
Yeah, I read an article on the RT yesterday, which I'm looking at right now. And the title to the article is Nevada Cops Sued Forced Occupation of Private Home. Basically, the story is the police were surveilling a home in the neighborhood. They approached two homeowners to use their home to surveil the house that they wanted to watch. And the guy said, I don't want to get involved. I don't want you to use my house. And they said, well, if you don't, then we'll arrest you for obstruction of justice. And they did. They came in. They kicked his door down with one of those battering rams. They shot his dog. They made him crawl on the floor while they shot him with pepper balls. Wow. It's a really crazy thing. But you just had, you know, a guy on that said, you know, he didn't know of a Third Amendment. Well, this is a Third Amendment.
Well, except the Third Amendment talks about, it says, no soldier shall in time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law.
I would agree with you, but I would say the militarization of our police force
has made them into soldiers.
Exactly. And to get forced out of your own home so that...
Is he launching a Third Amendment challenge to this?
Oh, yeah. They've already filed paperwork. That's what the article says. If you... I don't want to, you know, take up time to read it to you, but, you know, if you look it up on the RT, it's a pretty stunning story. And I live here in Havasu. Henderson's only 2 hours away from me.
That's amazing. Kelly, thank you for the call. Like I said, we have the smartest listeners on earth listening to this program. Anybody ever heard of the Third Amendment being violated? Yes, I know one. Amazing. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have an update on the Zimmerman trial with our legal expert, Debbie Hines of Legal Speaks, plus... Democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you to function. So get out there and get active. Show up. There's some great websites where you can actually get involved. You can create a local chapter of movetoamend.org or Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. Tag, you're it. And check out free-don.com as well. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.